65,498 square miles. We've got a lot to cover, so let's get to it. This is Spanning the State, and here are your hosts, Kristen Bry and Brian Noonan.
Good afternoon. All right, when you think of good government or civic affairs, do you think of optimism?
I'm sorry, did that come out?
That might be what a lot of people's reactions might be. Well, for this Giving Tuesday, we are talking to the leaders of a club that's been around for over 100 years and whose mission is, by providing hope and positive vision, optimists bring out the best in youth, our communities, and ourselves. So we got more of that at the end of this hour. And then in the next hour, there is an event this Thursday. It's called At the Intersection of Firearms and Mental Health, which is bringing attention to the fact that a majority of gun deaths in Wisconsin are actually people taking their own lives. And so it's an event that is bringing together gun owners who are trying to address that fact.
And we will also spin around the state after the 2 o'clock news. We're going to learn a little bit more about children's museums and ask you, what do you think it takes to be middle class in Wisconsin?
I wonder, what do you think it takes?
A lot of money. That's what
you think it
takes
a lot of money to be middle class?
It's an unfair question because I read the article. So I have the info. But yes, right.
Teaser for
that. Spoiler alert, yes, you need more money.
All right. Well, coming up first. So about a month ago, there was a report that was released that was commissioned by the University of Wisconsin system. They paid Deloitte $2.8 million.
That's good.
To assess the financial health of the individual campuses. And so that report was released, and I think there was a fair amount of people that thought, we spent almost $3 million to tell us what we already know.
Yeah, was that at the top of their report? Don't spend money on dumb reports.
Yeah, so it was $3 million basically to be told what a lot of people already know, that most UW campuses have an unsustainable reliance on their reserves and in order to try to cover budget deficits year after year. And so chancellors are finding a path to be difficult to remain financially sustainable while a lot of things we've talked on this show continue to happen. Enrollment declines, there's concerns about college affordability and the ROI of that, and state funding has remained flat for a while now. And so we're about 14 years into austerity programs that started under Scott Walker. And I think a lot of the conversation around the UW system and funding gets laid at the feet of Republicans and Scott Walker and what started then. But there is a little bit more inside knowledge of other reasons why we could be in the situation that we're in. And so when we come back, we're going to talk to a UW Oshkosh professor who argues that laying this problem and the budget deficits just at the feet of Republicans in Madison doesn't tell the whole story as to why UW campuses are in the situation that they're in. It also has to do with the fact that campuses should not be run like corporations.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So we will hear from him on the other side of this. This is Spanning the State.
Spanning the State. I'm Brian Noonan.
And I am Kristen Bry. And Brian, do you feel like there are some people who think that running a successful business qualifies you to run other organizations well?
I think there's a lot of people. We could start at the very top in a White House and move down. But I don't, there's no, I think, yes, there are people
who
believe
that.
I don't believe that is the case. I think business and other fields have different skills that need to be brought in. I think a lot of really successful business people are single-minded and want to work and make all the decisions on their own. And in other fields, you need a lot more input, a lot more cooperation. And so it's a difficult question.
It is a difficult question. So our next guest argues that it doesn't necessarily make you, just because you can run a business doesn't mean that's how organizations, campuses, government should be run, and including the University of Wisconsin, and argues that they've been running campuses like corporations, and that that is part of the reason those campuses are suffering. David Seemers is a professor of political science at UW Oshkosh and president of United Faculty and Staff of Oshkosh. Welcome to the show, David.
It's good to be with you.
So, give us a little bit of a history lesson in how the UW system practiced shared governance in previous years. Like, what did it look like and how did it work?
Yeah, well, the University of Wisconsin is a public good. And like any government or government entity, it's designed to have checks and balances, or it was originally designed to have them. And those checks and balances would be representative of the various stakeholders that this government entity would serve or represent. First of all, the citizens of the state, then the students, of course. They have an interest in how the place is run. Faculty and staff who often have long careers at the University of Wisconsin are stakeholders as well. The community, business community, state government itself is a stakeholder. So shared governance was a way in which all those stakeholders could be involved in decision making, and we generally made policies together.
When did that change? And because it's not like that now, the chancellors are pretty much empowered to do whatever they want.
Yeah, the chancellors are kind of like CEOs of the universities, and that happened around 2015. There was a change in the statutes. Governor Walker and his allies in the state government changed state statute to make shared governance something that was merely consultative. So when our chancellor kind of whispers in the ear of the faculty senate president, he can call that shared governance. And by the definition that we have now, it is. That doesn't really fit with the traditional model of what shared governance was.
What was the argument as to why that would be a good thing back in 2015?
You know, that's almost 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
But it's like they wanted a more efficient way of running universities, one that would turn universities quickly to something that they would rather see, which is kind of a vocational educational institution rather than a traditional liberal arts model of education.
Well, this sounds like it's rife for problems. What kind of problems have we seen in the last 10 years?
Yeah, I wrote an editorial about this in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and I outlined four things there that are probably not running optimally because of this. One, I don't think we make the best decisions because of this. No one has all the answers, and we need to listen and consult with each other to make the best decisions. Secondly, I think we have a problem attracting administrative talent in this state. We've got a national and even international pool for talent when it comes to universities. We want to attract the best people here. If year after year we're defunding the university and empowering chancellors, what are we empowering them to do? We're basically empowering them to make cuts, eliminating programs, saying no to people, furloughing people. I'm on furlough. You know, who wants to cut all the time? What kind of administrator is attracted to that? We can still get some terrific people, don't get me wrong. And every administrator is different, right? But we're not doing ourselves any favors by the way that we run our state institution this way. We have frayed morale. Those of us who have been here a while know how the place works, and we kind of expect to be listened to. That doesn't mean we have all the answers either. But when we're not consulted, it leads to poor morale. And when you have poor morale and are not listened to with this highly skilled and dedicated workforce, it's likely that people like me will go public saying that there are problems at the university. Look, all is not well at the UW system, and someone has to sound the alarm. Our chancellor once told me that he's a company man. And I think that the people who run the universities are under a kind of gag rule. Hmm. And the gag rule is this: only talk positively about what's going on. And they can't say, like, you know, we've got a $4 billion surplus. We should have more revenue to rehabilitate our institution to meet the 21st century most effectively. They can't say that. Someone has to sound the alarm, so we're doing that publicly.
And we're talking to David Seemers, who's a professor of political science at UW Oshkosh. I'm actually going to hold this question and ask it after we come after the break, but talking about airing dirty laundry, UW Oshkosh faculty did do that in the beginning of April. So we'll come back and hear what's happened since on Spanning the State.
It's Spanning the State. I'm Brian Noonan.
And I am Kristen Bry, and we are talking to David Seemers, who is a professor of political science at UW Oshkosh, about his argument that the University of Wisconsin is running campuses like corporations, and that is part of the reason why those campuses are suffering. So right before we went to break, David, we teased the fact that, if people remember, back in April, early April, the UW Oshkosh faculty voted no confidence in your chancellor. And so what has happened since then?
Well, we felt we needed to do that because this is such an important matter of public concern. And 72% of our faculty voted that they had no confidence in our chancellor. 2 hours later, the Board of Regents came out with a statement saying that they had full confidence in our chancellor. And all we did that same day, 2 hours earlier, was ask them to do their due diligence, consulting people in the community, alumni, donors, business leaders, people in the Fox Valley, about whether our chancellor has the right stuff for the job. So I don't think the Board of Regents was up for that.
Now, how do the unions, how does the faculty groups work then? Is the chancellor talking to you folks or not?
Well, six unions around the state at regional comprehensive universities asked chancellors for a meet and confer relationship. That is, we simply want to meet regularly with the chancellor to discuss working conditions. And this would take some of the pressure off of our faculty senate. They have a lot of stuff to do, and we simply want to have an audience with the chancellor to describe what we think might be in the good of the university. And all six universities turned that request down flat with the same kind of boilerplate language. And in fact, our chancellor said that it would be illegal to meet with us. It's not illegal for the chancellor to meet with anyone, right?
Right.
He has the same First Amendment rights as anyone to associate with the people whom he pleases. So, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, misinformation in the state about what unions can do. We are not able to collectively bargain by law, and we know we can't do that. But we have a First Amendment right to associate and a First Amendment right to speak. And because this is such a big issue of public concern, we are speaking out publicly.
And so what would it take to go back to the way it was? And is there any appetite for the people who would be in charge of reverting back? Is there any appetite to do that?
Yeah, I think chancellors on an individual basis can run their campus like a true shared governance campus. It's just very hard to do that in a time of deep austerity and where we're making cuts all the time, right? So it's much, you know, in one way, it's the path of least resistance to say, I'm going to make these decisions and go my own way and forget about input from other people. But absolutely 100%, there is the wish to go back to a meaningful shared governance model that works for all stakeholders. And it is not natural for teachers to be antagonistic and to fight and to go public. We want to help people, mm-hmm. right? And we want to create the best university system that we can have. And we've dedicated our careers to it. And we're absolutely 100% dedicated to the good of the institution, the good of our students, and doing what we can to right the ship.
David, we got about a minute left. Is there anything else we should know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've said some things that I don't want to be misconstrued. Going to a UW school to get a college education is a great value, and that there are thousands of dedicated professionals to help make that happen, and most of our students have a terrific experience here. We're the engine of progress in the state. We just need to rehabilitate the institutions and cooperate more and look forward to the 21st century at the University of Wisconsin.
Well, with that, David Seemers is a professor of political science at UW Oshkosh. I think this is a very compelling argument, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, David.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Well, like I said, I always think it's interesting when we talk about the value that we put on running a successful business. And we've, you know, because I think the thing with the CEO, and it's similar to what we were just saying with the chancellor versus shared governance, but when you're president, when you're governor, ultimately, even if it's an executive position, for things to work, you have to reach compromise. You have to negotiate. It has to be a collaborative effort. And with the CEO, the buck stops with you.
Right.
And it all rolls downhill.
And it's all about saving that money.
So it's two different skill sets. Very interesting. Again, that was Professor David Seemers. ABC News and local headlines are next. Welcome back to Spanning the State. I am Kristen Bry.
I'm Brian Noonan. I'm very busy.
Very busy.
I don't have time
very
to start talking.
Very busy looking into the new Ivies.
Oh, I hear that and I'm triggered by the Ivy League, because the high school I went to was all focused on Ivy League schools. Everybody had to go out east. Oh, you had to go to an Ivy League. You had to go here or there. And I was like, I don't want to go to an Ivy League school.
Yeah. Well, you're not alone anymore.
No, good.
And so there's more and more kids who are less interested in going to those highly regarded
Elite Eight
Ivy League schools, and then the Ivy Plus schools, which is MIT, University of Chicago, Stanford, and Duke.
Right.
But so Forbes, I don't know if you saw this, but Forbes selected colleges that they're calling the new Ivies.
Yes, I saw there was a list of public and private schools that have made that list, or two lists, the new
two Ivies. Lists. So there's 20 schools in total, and it was based on exclusivity and
really?
A survey of hiring managers it conducted to establish. So it's basically talked to hiring managers on like what schools do they look for on resumes,
yes.
And lo and behold. Despite our previous conversation of some of the woes of the UW system, University of Wisconsin-Madison did make that list for top 10 new Ivies for public schools.
They just got in because the acceptance rate for the public school, part of the criteria was you had to be under 50%.
Yes.
And UW-Madison comes in at 49% acceptance rate. So they squeaked in, which is good. Some of the others on that list... University of Illinois at Champaign, University of Florida, University of Maryland, University of Michigan, North Carolina, Texas, Virginia, all good schools. I remember when we were going through the lists, you know, trying to figure out schools back 8 years ago, it was, you know, a lot of these are perennial favorites.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and the thing is, for a lot of those really good public schools, it's great if you are in state. But if you were trying to apply to them from out of state, they are basically as expensive as any of the private schools you would be going to.
100%. My sister-in-law went to North Carolina, and she lived in North Carolina, so it was a state school. When we looked, it was like, oh, my God, this is as expensive as anywhere else.
Yeah.
But that's good for them. What I found really interesting was not only that students are going away from those Elite Eight, the old school Ivy Leagues, but hiring managers really have turned on graduates from those Ivy League schools. And they're like, because 33% of hiring managers said they would not hire graduates. from Ivy League, or they were less likely to. 20% said the Ivy League colleges are doing worse than 5 years ago to prepare job candidates. And this, they also said that graduates from Ivy League schools feel more entitled. And I'm like, aha, there it is. We've been saying it all along. So they're more likely to hire public university graduates. I don't know, maybe as much as people will shout that Madison is, liberal elite and blah, 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 they must be doing something right, because people would rather hire students from University of Wisconsin-Madison than Harvard or Yale.
And that is, I mean, how do you measure entitlement?
I don't know.
Is it all just anecdotal?
I'll tell you something. I need more money. They're saying that the problem is, the hiring managers are saying, that instead of focusing on accepting the most well-rounded students, they're looking at, let's get the most well-rounded class.
Oh.
So the class as a whole, we need people who check this box and this box and this box, instead of looking at student A, student B, and student C and going, yeah, student A's grades might not be as good as student B, but student A also was involved in charity work and was on the basketball team and was in theater and debate. And student B, they had all honors classes, but that's really all they did.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not looking at that. They want to say, oh, we need women and we need some foreign students and we need somebody from this geographic region of the United States. And the hiring manager is saying that's not the way to educate people.
Yeah. I also think it's interesting because who I was at 18 versus who I was at 22.
Right.
Was very different. At 18, I still thought I was going to be an Oscar-nominated actress someday.
All right, fair enough.
And by 22, I was, like, very into school. And
yeah, Hollywood beats that out of you
Measures used, or the criteria used to measure 18-year-olds and what schools they get into, I would hope that they've evolved, and it's not what hiring managers are like basing their hiring decisions on of what you were doing at 18, even though you've now graduated from college.
Right.
But hopefully you've grown since then. But
right. But getting it, the difference between getting into the college and getting hired are completely different too. So,
yeah. Well, either way, congratulations to University of Wisconsin-Madison. When we come back, a club that's been around for 100 years based on optimism. This is Spanning the State.
It's Spanning the State. Oh, that music can only mean one thing.
It is Giving Tuesday, our Tuesday segment where we talk about good news, good organizations, and good people doing good across Wisconsin. And there's we'll say clubs.
Sure.
There's many of them that some have been around for over 100 years, which is a task. When I was at the Milwaukee County Historical Society Awards dinner last year,
right.
Last week, they said some stat as far as companies that make it to their 100th anniversary is less than a half of 1%. And so I have to imagine that nonprofits, community organizations are similar. But the Optimist International is global, and they have many chapters/clubs in Wisconsin. And their mission? Providing hope and positive vision. Optimists bring out the best in youth, our communities, and ourselves. So joining us now are the two people who oversee the two districts of Optimist Clubs here in Wisconsin. Chuck Erickson, who oversees clubs in northern Wisconsin, and Diane Matusak, who oversees clubs in southern Wisconsin. Welcome to the show, guys.
Oh, my God. Well, hello.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Hello.
Yes.
All right. So, Chuck, let's start. How do you describe what the Optimist Club is to someone who's never heard of it? Because I, until I had read this in the newspaper, had never heard of it, despite how long it's been around.
Yeah, I agree with you. We are one of the best-kept secrets in America. Optimist International has been around as an international organization for over 100 years. And what I love about Optimist International are these are people who – are in local clubs. Many of our clubs are in small towns and villages scattered throughout Wisconsin and around the country and around the world. And we are here to do good in our communities. We're here to support our youth, to make a difference in the lives of our youth, improve our communities, and in turn, improve ourselves. So we are just here to be optimistic people, to make a difference in our areas.
Well, as I read up on some of the history, I was surprised. The Optimist Club started out, their slogan was to be a friend to delinquent boys. which I could have used a friend, Chuck, quite frankly, back in the day.
Yeah.
But when did things evolve into what they've become now?
Really, it was a big change happened just about 35, 40 years ago was the big change where we were originally founded by businessmen who were trying to make a difference in, as you mentioned, delinquent boys. And we switched to supporting youth of all kinds really about 35, 40 years ago. And also we allowed women to join our organization about 40 years ago. So that was also a huge change. So now we really are welcoming and accepting for everyone.
Nice.
And we work with all types of youth really from birth all the way through 18.
So Diane, so there's Optimist International is over 100 years old. There's Wisconsin clubs that have also reached that milestone. Which ones are that old, first of all?
Well, the one in Milwaukee is 100 years old. They are actually one of our first ones over here in the southern Wisconsin, which is I'm governor of. It's called the Swiss District. Southern Wisconsin. It's not cheese. It's southern Wisconsin. That was one of our oldest. A lot of people call it, what is it, why you call it Swiss cheese? Yeah, they have been around a long time. In fact, we in the Swiss District here have just celebrated our third conference out in over here in Milwaukee at the Hilton Garden Inn. We do wonderful things. We do wonderful things like the oratorical contest. We just gave out a first place prize of $2,500 to our first place contestant who won. That person will then go on to the national contest, which I think it's a $5,000 prize. So we do things. It doesn't matter if they're 100 years old. It doesn't matter if it's a two-year-old club. One of the wonderful things about the Optimist International is that if you've got 10 or 15 people that say, let's do something, you can start an Optimist Club. You've got an idea. You've got a goal. You've got a fundraiser that we haven't heard of yet. Kick it out there. That's what's the wonderful thing about the Optimist Clubs. We're really autonomous, and we can all do our own fundraising or our own event.
Chuck, do you think the autonomy of the different chapters, different clubs, is what's led to its longevity, or what other reason do you think might contribute to that?
Absolutely. It's because Optimist International provides us with these wonderful programs like the oratorical contest or the essay contest. So they're really just programs that you can initiate in your area very quickly. But also, we really encourage clubs to listen to their community. What do you need in your area? For example, the Brilliant Optimist Club right now is in their final fundraising to build a brand new accessible playground for the village of Brilliant so that they could have a really up-to-date playground area for their kids. That was something that the community really wanted, and the Optimist Club stepped up and said, we are going to help with the fundraising of this and figuring out what equipment we want and making it happen. So that's really what a club can do. If you purchase cheese curds from your local fair, whether it's the county fair or your regional carnivals, they're probably served by an Optimist Club. If you've been to the Two Rivers Kite Festival, you've eaten the food created by the Optimist Club there. So really, we're taking on local tasks and projects to make a difference in our specific communities.
We're talking to Chuck Erickson and Diane Matuzak, who are the governors of both each district for the Optimist International Clubs around Wisconsin. And I guess this is more of an esoteric, bigger question, but I have been accused of being an optimist in my life. Ooh. And so I guess as two people who are the governors of all the different chapters that are in your districts, what do you think the connection is between optimism or an optimistic disposition and good government or civic engagement?
Yeah.
Chuck, you and I discussed this.
You're bringing up.
You were going to take that one. Go ahead.
It's It's one of the purposes of Optimus International is to promote good governance and self and civic engagement, because, again, that goes back to getting our clubs involved at the local level. We want our clubs to engage with their local leadership, their local, you know, town or village or city mayors, and say, how can we help improve our community and be engaged in our community? So my
and
local chapter in Appleton. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I didn't want to jump in. I just wanted to say, as far as that goes, we also have one of our programs is Respect for Law, talking about government, correct? And May is National Law Enforcement Appreciation Month. And one of our programs in Optimus International is Respect for Law all over the southern Wisconsin, the Swiss District, and I'm sure up there in Winnem, Chuck, we are all celebrating Respect for Law. It doesn't have to be in May, but May is that month. We just had an event this morning in Janesville where they were respecting the government. All the police officers came in. We're having another one tonight at Wanaki Golf Course. We are celebrating the Chief of Butler, the Sussex Chief, and Lannan. It's open to the public, 6 o'clock to 7:30. So that's just another way that we stay involved.
Absolutely. Well, we only have about a minute left, so I just want to make sure people, how can people find their local chapter?
All
sure,
right, you know what?
Go to
Optimus.
Diane first,
ahead,
and then Chuck.
Okay, there's optimus.org. You go to optimus.org, and you just have to, like anything else, just navigate until you find the answer. Or you can email me, dmatuzak1@wi.rr.com. Matuzak, like John Matuzak, the Oakland Raider.
There you go. All right. Chuck Erickson, Diane Matuzak, thank you so much. Optimist International, Wisconsin Optimist Clubs, spread the joy. Thank you so much
thank
for your
you
time
both.
Today.
Thank you
for
the opportunity.
Us.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Newstime 154. This is Spanning the State.
It's time to take a spin around Wisconsin and find stories you might have missed. Here's Spinning the State on Spanning the State with Kristen Bry and Brian Noonan.
Yes, every day after the 2 o'clock news, we take a spin around Wisconsin and see if we can find some stories you may not have heard of. Now, sometimes like this first story, I think somebody else may have touched on it, but it's always good to repeat. So let's spin the wheel, Kristen, and see where we're going.
Ogdensburg.
We have not been to Ogdensburg. I have not been there in person, and we have not been there on Spinning the State. But the reason we go there today, Buffalo. Not the Buffalo Lodge that Fred Flintstone was part of.
Not the game where you have to drink with your opposite hand?
I don't know that game.
Oh, that off air. We'll bring it back.
All right. Well, Rhea, mark that down. We've got to play Buffalo. About 6 o'clock yesterday morning, a citizen... A good citizen called the Wapaka County Sheriff's Office to report that a buffalo was on the roadway north of the village of Ogdensburg, about 40 miles northwest of Appleton, for those of you who were plotting this story out on a map. As of 8:30 today, the Sheriff's Office said it had not received any additional calls about the buffalo, which maybe means somebody was drinking and thought they saw a buffalo on the loose. Sheriff's Office has no additional descriptive information about the animal, nor any photos or videos. Is that really necessary? How many buffalo? They've already said they haven't seen one. So it's not like they have to round up a gaggle of buffalo. And
what is the plural of buffalo?
Buffaloes?
Probably.
No, give
it's
me
a
buffalo.
It's a murder
buffalo
of crows,
roam.
A gaggle of geese.
A bunch of buffalo?
Text line, 855-616-1620. What is a bunch of buffaloes
bunch of
called,
buffaloes.
Officially?
And if you're a police officer and you really need a description of a buffalo, it might be time to look up another job. But officials do believe that it escaped from a nearby farm. This is always good news, too, and I love that we have to tell people this because they're so bright. People are requested to use caution when driving in the area where the buffalo was spotted. And if you see the animal... The sheriff's department says not to approach it, as the species is, quote unquote, unpredictable. Yes. So if you want a selfie with the buffalo, you need to sign a waiver with all of us to say that we're not coming to help you. If you wander up to a buffalo and go, say cheese, and it gores you, I'm sorry, but that's just nature weeding out the stupid.
That is Darwinism, yes. Ladies and gentlemen. All right.
All right, where are we going next?
Let's find out.
Lacrosse.
Both in lacrosse and in a Quick Trip near you.
Maybe.
Quick Trip will be selling Blueberry Dunker potato chips. Ugh. At least for a limited time. Yes, if you are a fan of Blueberry Donut.
They're Dunkers, I gotta say.
If you're a fan of the Blueberry Donut Dunkers,
yes.
You may be a fan of these potato chips. To me, sounds a little weird. I will gladly try them, which Brian tried valiantly to try to make happen today, but indeed failed.
Yesterday after the show, I stopped at the Quick Trip in Kenosha. And I looked all over, and they have like three different areas of chips. And I'm looking. And finally, I went up to the guy behind the register and said, hey, this is kind of stupid. But do you have these blueberry chips? And he goes, oh, this guy over here was just telling me about it, another employee. And the guy came scurrying over, and he was like, oh, yeah. Man, we were supposed to get them last weekend, but they didn't come in, so maybe next weekend or later in the week. He goes, but I got to try them. And then the original guy I talked to went, yeah, I kind of want to try them too, but they sound kind of gross.
Sound kind of weird.
Yeah, so there, and I stopped. Then I stopped at the Quick Trip on Ryan Road this morning, thinking maybe the Kenosha store got short shrift of the Blueberry Dunker potato chips, but no, nobody's got them yet.
All right, well, eventually. Maybe this week, maybe next week, but there's going to be a debut of Blueberry Dunker flavored Urge potato chips in Quick Trip. Eventually, we will buy them, we will try them, but for now, we have to be patient.
Now we dream.
One more.
Spin it.
Madison.
All right, this story is not funny at all, and being from Madison, I wonder if you knew about it. I had never heard of this story. Have you heard of Chimney Dough?
No.
All right. So after more than 30 years, investigators have finally figured out a name to tie to this crime. Skeletal remains were found in a chimney on September 3rd, 1989. That was in a Madison business. Due to technological advances of DNA, they have finally identified the skeleton as Ronnie Joe Kirk. Police unearthed a skeleton after the owner of the now shuttered Good and Loud Music Store on University Avenue. Did you ever go there?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, guess what? When you were in there, there was a skeleton in the chimney. Enjoy your ABBA album. So they spotted this skull visible through a pipe connecting the boiler to the building's chimney. Investigators now know, after going through different websites and different databases, that Kirk was born in 1942 in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He was raised by genetic relatives who adopted him. They still don't know exactly how or when Kirk died, according to Madison police. A forensic autopsy previously concluded the remains belonged to a genetic male who was between 18 and 35 years old, about 5'7". Police shared Monday that Kirk was raised in Tulsa and had ties to Texas and Alabama. But finally, after 30-some years, they figured it out.
I guess that's good.
Yeah,
to give some closure.
Well, this would be like a true crime because there's a ton of other details.
Yeah,
like he was found. There was a dress in there and a cross and some other stuff. So they don't know what's going on. They have no idea. But it's a fascinating case.
Cold case.
Yeah, very cold.
Get to the bottom of it.
Well, it's right by the boiler, which would make it seem not such a cold case, and yet still. We're all done. And just circling back, it's a herd of buffalo.
All right.
That's
a little more obvious than I was hoping.
Yes.
So I was hoping it was going to be alliteration.
No, unfortunately.
It is not.
A bag of buffalo. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we are going to learn about children's museums because a huge event is happening this week at the Madison's Children's Museum. But Wisconsin is chock full of children's museums. So we will talk about that after this on Spanning the State.
Welcome back to Spanning the State. I am Kristen Bry.
I'm Brian Noonan. I don't know if you know this, but Wisconsin is home to 25 children's museums.
Did I know that? I knew that we had a lot.
Well, now you do. 25. This week, the Madison Children's Museum is hosting Interactivity 2024 Flourish. It's the largest international conference of children's museums. This year, 14 countries are going to be represented at the conference. And to tell us more about children's museums and their importance to children's education is the executive director of the Association of Children's Museums, Arthur Affleck. Arthur, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Well, good. All right, let's start with the very basics. Can you define what a children's museum is?
Yes. So a children's museum, most of them are nonprofit organizations committed to serving the needs and interests of children by providing exhibits and programs that stimulate curiosity, motivate learning, and support the well-being of children and families. And one other thing I'll say is that most other museums have lots of collections and focus on those collections and artifacts. Children's museums focus on people, children and families. We have a few artifacts, we have a few collections, but mostly our program is about enhancing the lives of kids and their families.
So what is the role of the Association of Children's Museums?
So ACM is the foremost professional society supporting children's museums. We have 480 members in all 50 states, and as you said, about 11 or 12 countries. And so we convene the field as we're doing this week. This will be, by the way, the largest convening in our 60-year history. We thought it was New Orleans last year was the largest. This one actually is turning out to be even larger, with over 1,000 people expected to be at the Monona Terra Community and Convention Center over the next couple of days.
Wow.
That's very exciting. And on that note, Madison is one of the smaller cities that has hosted the event. What goes into choosing not only the host museum, but the host city?
So Madison, you all live here, I've been here several times, is a wonderful, walkable city. We have a great children's museum partner. We pick a city also thinking about the children's museum partner, and the children's museum here in Madison, led by Deb Gilpin, as a great institution, a great museum, great people to work with. And we wanted a place that would, not be too expensive for our guests. And Madison is beautiful. Most people don't know. It's on an isthmus, and you can see the water. So we're thrilled to be here and looking forward to a great couple of days.
So what is covered during interactivity?
So this is the opportunity for the field to do a couple things. And we survey them and we ask them why they come. Number one, they come for professional development. We have hundreds of sessions and workshops and speakers that will share information and knowledge about the field, whether it's exhibitions or educational programming or a range of issues. So they come for the education. Also, the networking. When you get to meet with hundreds of your colleagues from museums, or almost 1,000 from all over the country, that is very important, that networking piece. And then they come here to see a new museum. Many of them have never been to Madison. They get to see not only the Madison Children's Museum, but they'll go visit other children's museums in the region when they come this close. So that's why they come. And as I said, our field has been growing. Children's museums are the fastest growing segment of the museum community, not art museums, not history museums. Children's museums are the fastest growing field because of the needs of children and families today have been greater than ever, I think, in our history.
I was gonna have a joke question about what's the disposition of children's museums professionals and on how good are the parties at this conference. But now I actually want to ask about that fact, and the fact that this is that's how fast this is growing. Is that just because there's such a need for places for parents to bring their kids to interact with exhibits like this?
Yes, and I think especially coming out of the pandemic, parents realize that, as much as you love your kids can't stay at home all the time. And kids spend maybe 20% of the time in schools. 80% of the time, young people, children are outside of school somewhere doing something. And we need to have productive spaces that are safe, that are engaging, that are places of learning. We talk about playful learning. You have fun in our museums, but everything is designed to teach there's a lesson, a learning objective around everything that we do. So, you know, kids have fun in our museums, but they're learning as well. And then there's something called learning loss, that if you think about the summer after school, if you're not engaging kids productively, then they lose some of the learning they learned in school. So we are that third space, if you will, where families can come and have a great time. And we're intergenerational. You often see grandparents and parents in our museums, you know, with kids, and we welcome all of that.
So you brought up the term playful learning, and that's something that I know is starting to come into preschools and kindergartens, especially where the curriculums are changing into that learning by play. What are the benefits of that kind of learning as opposed to sit down, learn your arithmetic, learn how to write your letters? What makes this more or as beneficial for a young child?
So there's a lot of research that shows that when children are playing and are more open to what is being shared with them, they retain it better. As a matter of fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics once had a play prescription that said children subjected to toxic stress and other kinds of challenges in the community and in homes, you know, that they would give them a play prescription, let them go out and play either outside in parks or in children's museums. So there is also social and emotional development, that children develop more social and emotional development skills by playing. We want them to learn how to, like, play nice in the sandbox, as you say, and those skills will be with them for the rest of their lives. So, yeah, play is learning, full stop. But also play is therapeutic.
It seems, as I was looking not only at the children's museums I've been to, but the other ones in the state, there are similarities and there's differences. Other than being interactive, what are some of the unique qualities that you've seen as you've gone to not only Madison, but some of the other children's museums here in Wisconsin and across the country?
Yeah, so I've been to over 100 children's museums, and people always ask me, so, you know, what's the best, you know, and I'm in Madison today. So Madison, you know, Madison,
there you go.
Top of my list. But they're all unique, as you said. And so in size, half of our museums are small. They may have a budget of less than $1 million, and the others are larger. So there are a couple key things. Most of them have something called water play. Most of them have a climber of some sort. Most of them have a maker space or a place where you can do, you know, kind of art. Some of them have STEM exhibits for science, technology, with the arts connected to that. What differs is that many of them also will have some reference to the local community. So if you go to the Madison Children's Museum, you'll see references to local architects. You'll see references to, you know, to the topography. So kids will learn more about their communities in each museum. Pittsburgh looking different from Brooklyn, looking different from Miami. Miami has a cruise ship in the middle of the museums. Why? Because that's what they do in Miami, right? So,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Kids. So that's one way that they're different, although they all try to engage kids, you know, in fun, productive ways. And one of the things I love, I was in the Magic House in St. Louis last year, and kids were leaving the Magic House. They were crying because they didn't want to leave. And I just, you know, I was laughing because it was so joyful that they loved the place so much they didn't want to leave. And that happens in a lot of children's museums, that kids have such a great time, don't really realize all the stuff they're learning, and don't want to leave. And that's what you want when you're a kid. You want kids to just have that kind of joyful experience.
Well, before we let you go, Arthur, we've got a text from the membership and communication manager at the Children's Museum in Fond du Lac, who is coming to Interactivity for the first time this week. And then somebody texted in recommending the Baraboo Children's Museum, too. So 25
yes.
Great children's museums here in Wisconsin.
Yes.
14 countries represented this week at Interactivity 2024 Flourish. Arthur, it's been a lot of fun talking to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Take care. Arthur Affleck is the Association of Children's Museums Executive Director. We'll be back. Oh, no, we got to take a break, and then it's news time. Stick with us. It's Spanning the State.
All right, we're back just long enough to tell you that news and ABC headlines are next. And then after that, we're going to be talking about an event happening in Wausau on Thursday. Well, welcome back to Spanning the State. I am Kristen Bry.
And I am Brian Noonan. And Thursday, you are not going to be here.
But I will.
But you will be on the show.
Yes.
You will
technology.
Be, technology is our friend because you are part of a very interesting, important, and it sounds cool. I'll throw cool in there, too, because I think when people hear what this is about, it's and who is involved and how it's framed, it is a different take on a couple of topics that we hear about all the time.
So if people remember, if people who read the Journal Sentinel probably remember, sure. But I can't remember if John maybe came on to any of the news shows to talk about this pretty massive project called Behind the Gun, which was a series that he did for, he was the lead of the reporters from Journal Sentinel that was over a year,
wow.
Basically. The Journal Sentinel examined the full extent of gun deaths in Wisconsin.
Okay.
And so it was like first of its kind to obtain gun death data from every single county in Wisconsin. He talked to dozens of gun owners about their experiences with firearms and also conducted like an in-depth survey of gun owners in Wisconsin to date. And the reason behind this is because gun deaths in Wisconsin have doubled since 2004. And the trend is really driven by suicides.
Okay.
And so, and this is especially in the more rural northern parts of the state. And so, John Dietrich, who we've interviewed before on his Delta 8 story more recently, he, after doing this series, after taking all of this on, after making all of these new relationships with people who are gun shop owners and veterans and military and therapists who are specifically trained to talk to other gun owners and all this stuff. He's like, I feel like we need to do an event. Like we need to do something with all of the information that we've gathered and what we've written on. And so that's exactly what we're doing. So we're having a free event. It's in Wausau, which is a little outside of our listening area at this point. But I would say if you're listening to us and you're in Green Bay or the Fox Valley, it's a little bit closer to you, but you can also watch it live, because we're live streaming it.
Oh,
because we thought it was important to live stream and capture everything that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So people can watch it later. People can watch it live. Obviously, Wausau's a, you know, not everyone lives within driving distance to Wausau. And so it's called The Intersection of Firearms and Mental Health, and it's going to be held at the UW Center for Civic Engagement in Wausau. I'm the MC. I'm not giving any of the information because this is outside of my scope. But everyone who's actually talking works there. It's ex-military, veterans, people who are law enforcement, people who own gun shops, and their attempt at this really weird middle ground that I think even in us trying to drive attendance for this event have found of there is such, the narrative around gun ownership is so black and white, I think. And I think a lot of gun owners feel very, the hackles go up at any given point of like, this event is going to be talking about taking our guns away, and it's not.
That's what I wanted to clarify.
From like a marketing standpoint, and how do you talk about this intersection without it and reaching the people that it's supposed to reach without it sounding like we're trying to take your guns away, which is not what this event is about.
It's a whole different thing, and I think responsible gun owners and knowledgeable gun owners are probably not the ones who are going to freak out. They're going to say, oh, well, okay, this is a startling statistic. The fact that, you know, what can we do about it? This is not, you know what? A lot of people are dying because of gun deaths. There's a lot of suicides. We want to take your guns. That's not what's happening.
No.
But it's a conversation that needs to be had because, you know, people do have guns in their homes, and if they're having mental problems, if they're having a breakdown, if there's all of that plays in, that doesn't necessarily mean 2 weeks ago you were an irresponsible gun owner.
Mm-hmm.
It's all of a sudden now something terrible has happened to you, and it's there. So
yeah,
let's figure it out.
So the goal of the night is basically just to start conversations and make space for people who are concerned about this issue and provide the chance for some people to connect. There's going to be you know, a lot of Q&A, a lot of tabling and stuff like that for people to get more information. So if you would like to get more information about the event, you can text BEHIND to 855-616-1620, and we will text you the link that has more information about everyone who's going to be there, why the series itself. So again, that's Behind, B-E-H-I-N-D, 855-616-1620. If you text Behind to the WTMJ Talk and Text Line, we will send you the link for more information on the intersection of firearms and mental health happening on Thursday.
Very nice. And you mentioned there's gun owners, there's educators, there's all kinds of people who will be speaking.
Yeah, absolutely.
And John will kind of
John will be there. Conducting the entire event.
Well, a year, it's amazing to me the dedication of journalists who will put in that much time on a story.
And we're gonna get to talk to him today, and we're gonna air that interview on Thursday, because I have such admiration for how he has tried to. When something's this big and you've talked to this many people, and trying to summarize it in any kind of coherent way is a task. And so, how hard he has worked on bringing all these people together, and I think everyone who's involved feels like if this event can reach one person. Mm-hmm. It will have been worth it.
And just since we're teasing Thursday, pardon me, that we're going to be talking to John, too. We're also going to be talking to one of the speakers at the town hall. And his story is not one that you would expect maybe to be at an event like this. So you'll want to be here Thursday to listen to that interview as well.
Yep. So text Behind to 855-616-1620 if you want more information about the Behind the Gun series and also the event that is happening on Thursday. News Time 242. This is Spanning the State.
I need a dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, dollar, dollar.
It's Spanning the State. I am Kristen Bry.
I'm Brian Noonan. What do you think it takes to be considered middle class in Wisconsin? Now, middle class used to be...
As a household or as an individual?
A household, but individual goes with the same thing. If you want to live a middle class lifestyle, which used to be that was the goal for most people. And then it was, well, are you upper middle class? Are you lower middle class? Are you middle class? It all got kind of messed up. But, you know, when I was growing up, I think we were middle class or upper lower middle class. Like the
upper lower?
It's the top end of the lower middle class. You know, we're not the bottom of the lower middle class, but we're not big shots. But you know, that all that meant was that you had a place to live, you had a house, you could afford to send your kids to school. Maybe only one parent had to work, and everything was fine. You could, you know, go on vacation maybe once a year and drive usually. But it was an attainable dream. And it's not so much anymore.
Anywhere?
Well, no. But here in Wisconsin, across the nation, the middle class is shrinking.
Yes. That's been a trend for a while.
Yes. Household incomes are rising considerably since 1970, but adults living in middle class households fell from 61% in 1971 to 50% in 2021. That's according to numbers from the Pew Research Center and their analysis of government data. So to be considered middle class in Wisconsin, you'll need a household income between where do you think the low end is, Kristen? Around.
Because what is it? Okay. I'm just going to guess because I don't know.
You got to guess.
I would say middle class in Wisconsin, household income is somewhere between 50 and 80.
Okay.
$1,000 a year.
You were very close on the low end.
Okay.
$47,326, which seems pretty low. Up to about $142,000. That is way too much of a range.
That's a big range.
Yeah, I mean,
like people making $47,000 a year versus $140,000 a year. It's a big difference of lifestyle.
Yeah, I think if we talk to someone from each household and ask them if they were middle class, I'm going to guess the higher end income is going to say yes, and the people making $47,000 are going to go, well, we're struggling a lot,
yeah,
you know, with rents and things. So the state's median household income is $70,996. So for reference, the Pew Research defines middle class income as two-thirds to double the median income in an area.
Say that again. So you take the median income of the area.
Income, middle-class income is two-thirds to double the median income in the area.
Okay, so if the median...
So double would be 142.
Yeah, okay.
And two-thirds, I guess, then would be 47.
Feels like a suspect way of measuring that.
I don't know. Nationwide in a large U.S. city, middle-class income averages between 52 and 155,000. That was according to Smart Assets. So, to live as a middle-class person in Milwaukee is not quite as much as Wisconsin's average, which is nice. Milwaukee's middle class makes between $32,843 and $98,540. The city's median household income is $49,270.
Okay.
Again, those low ends seem... I think the whole definition of middle class has shifted because that's low.
Well, it's interesting because... I think it depends on the definition you're working with middle class, right? So there's a definition they're using, which is like, well, we're just going to take the numbers are the numbers. And this is what we're saying is it's two-thirds up to double versus the interpretation of what we used to think middle class was, which is what you could afford to do and the type of home you could live in and the neighborhood that you lived in and that being an indicator of being in the middle class versus a like black and white hard numbers definition.
Well, there's real world and then there's, and this is basically what you're saying. There's real world and then there's numbers. And
it's perception.
I think
if you ask someone, like you just said, if you ask someone who is making closer to from $35,000 to $50,000 for their household income, they probably would not consider themselves middle class considering how much they may or may not be struggling versus someone who, depending on how much self-awareness they have, is making close to $150,000 as a household and has extra spending money and stuff.
Sure.
Maybe would be aware that, oh, we're doing better than most.
Yeah.
But who knows where they would put themselves on the map, as they say.
Well, it's a very, it's one of those things where middle class used to be so much more inclusive, and I don't know where it all changed, where it all went wrong, but it is tougher. There's also another level that hadn't brought up yet, but Wisconsin has one of the country's biggest racial wealth gaps.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So a report said that Wisconsin has the third largest racial wealth gap in the country behind Washington, D.C. and North Dakota. I'm surprised that there's that much racial diversity in North Dakota. And I don't mean that glibly.
No, I've been to North Dakota. I'm going to be totally honest. That's exactly where my mind went, too. I was like, I don't think of black people in North Dakota very often.
Nor do I. White Wisconsinites earn about 50% more than their black neighbors, according to this report. And black residents are around 244% more likely to live in poverty than whites here in Wisconsin. So.
Not great.
There you go. No, it's not feeling really good about the middle class anymore. I gotta just give in. Just go low class.
Do you consider yourself middle class?
I'm going to stay where I was at the beginning of this conversation. I would be lower middle class, I think.
Okay.
I'm doing doing okay, but nothing where I could just kick back and not worry.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm doing better. I'm doing better than a lot of people. I'm not doing as well as a lot of people, so I'm somewhere toward that lower part of the middle. Yeah,
all right.
That's me. All right, let's do this. Then there's more. It's Spanning the State. It is Spanning the State. We're just about to get out of here, and that means that John Mercure and Julia Fellow are coming in for Wisconsin's Afternoon News. What's going on, John? What do you got coming up?
I got a lot of stuff coming up. So the airlines, remember last week we discussed that they rolled out that they were going to fine the airline. The government was going to fine the airlines if the airlines didn't disclose fees for bags and other things. Well, now the airlines are fighting back. They're suing the U.S. government saying it's too confusing for people if we put all the language about the fees on the front of the website.
Really?
People are dummies. We don't want to confuse them.
I'll agree with part of that, but I think if you give people just the straight up price, they'll understand it.
Dupe them into getting us more money. Why are you making us tell the truth?
Listen, dummies, don't look at this. We're going to just charge you this.
With a straight face, how do they make that argument? But they are. So we're going to discuss that coming up this afternoon. Also, Michael Cohen is under cross-examination, and the Trump trial will be in New York with the very latest on that. Major Garrett, our friend, joins us. Marty Brooks runs the Baird Center in the Wisconsin Center District and all that good stuff. My exclusive conversation with Marty Brooks coming up at 4:15. And those wildfires are causing problems for us. That smoke in Canada is once again an issue. Dr. John Raymond with us live in the studio as we sort through that this afternoon. It's the news up next. You guys have a great night.
You too.
It's 2:57.